our times call for pessimism of the intellect but optimism of the will. And in a sense, I apply that to the environment and to society. And I do believe that there is no salvation for the environment without a salvation for our society, and particularly for the poorest people in our society.
Hello and welcome to The Family of Things, a podcast about life and how we choose to live it. I'm Helen Shaw, and my guest today is a man I used to share a newsroom with many moons ago when we both worked in the Irish Times. It's journalist and author Paddy Woodworth, whose writing weaves threads of culture, politics, and the natural sciences. When our paths crossed in the Irish Times in the 1980s, Paddy was perhaps best known for his coverage of Spain and the Basque conflict. But today, he's a lyrical storyteller of nature. His epic work, Our Once and Future Planet, is a call to action to us to pay attention to our world, to restore our environment in this climate change century. Welcome, Paddy. How are you? I think you're in Wicklow today, which is where your lockdown habit has been. How is Wicklow today?
Wicklow's mixed today. It's very lovely. It's an incredible time of year with all the hawthorn out. But it sometimes becomes very dark and cloudy as well.
Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful day here in Dublin. And I have to say, the birds are nesting. I know you're a mad bird watcher and have a huge interest. So I have heard that there's been some issues for the blue tits because we had such a cold spell earlier. But I'm delighted to say I have blue tits nested and blackbirds, and they're all enjoying some water in the garden at the moment.
And can you see the blackbird nest?
I can hear it. I can't see the nest, but I can hear it because the chicks are very loud.
we have wrens nesting right above our door, and so it's on a they're nesting in the house, and in the exterior part of the house, but on a deck, and so when I'm having my breakfast, the wrens get very upset because they come and they perch and they bounce about a yard away from me, but they're kind of usually too nervous to fly up to the nest. So now I take the chair out onto the lawn, and then they can come in and out, and they don't feel inhibited.
How beautiful. That's so lovely. I'm definitely one of these people who became more aware of bird life, of bird song and nature with the pandemic, because walking every day, spending more time in my garden, and in a sense being grateful for that. And we probably all hope that it's one of the things, one of the good things that will come out of this period of pause. But for you, nature's been a constant. I mean, you grew up with that love from your parents, I think.
Yeah, I grew up with it, and then I lost it, and then I found it again. I never lost it completely as a love of nature, but birds in particular. I was fascinated by birds as a child, and we lived in unusual circumstances every summer in that my parents rented out our house in Bray, and we moved to what I later discovered was actually a British Army Nissan hut, which somebody had transferred, I think, from the Tallaght camp to the Sugarloaf. And we had no running water and no electricity for 3 months of the year. And it was quite a magical life. And at a very early age, I can remember as a very young child, building a zoo. And you get a very obliging postman, because I used to ask him to bring me a new animal every day, like a hippo or a giraffe or something like that. And I became fascinated by birds. My parents were kind of all-rounders.
But hang on a sec. Where was the postman getting all these animals?
I have no idea. They were it was all imaginary, but he played along with the game, which was lovely. He just, you know, After I asked him once or twice, he you know, every day would. I mean, I think I would ask him for the animal, and he'd say yes, here it is, and pass me something which wasn't anything. And I built these little cages on
how
the
magical,
grass.
How magical. I mean, were your parents very into nature? Tell me a little bit about them.
I think they kind of regarded being interested in nature as part of being a human being. You know, they weren't naturalists. I suppose they kept some records. I'm thinking back to their kind of bird books and plant books. There would have been little notes in them occasionally. I mean, they were very good parents in the sense that I think they, with all of us, encouraged the interests we had. And were very positive about it. I mean, I think they found me, you know, they probably had to suppress a bit of irritation when I became really obsessed with birds between about 10 and 14. And really didn't want to do much else except go out and watch birds. But it wasn't just birds. I loved being out in landscapes, and I loved being out in landscapes on my own. And so I had this, another thing that, you know, very few children, I guess, could do today was that, you know, I spent long hours on my own on the Sugarloaf. And it was kind of a dreamy kind of existence, I guess. I read a lot. I don't think I brought books with me on walks, so I was interested in everything I was seeing, but for some reason never developed an interest in plants, which my mother did know about, and I think that was a bit of a disappointment to her. But she learnt more about birds because I was interested in birds.
And your family, so the Woodwards, Protestant, Bray, and in many ways, I suppose, middle class. How would you see your childhood growing up in the 50s?
I mean, as I came to see them later, they were a kind of odd mix of class. I mean, my father was very much solid Dublin kind of accountancy, Protestant middle class. My mother came from faded, very, very faded landed gentry. And they kind of needled each other about that, you know, echoes of class. But they were ambitious for us, so I was sent to a prep school, which I hated many aspects of, and I particularly hated its very West British ethos, which was not the ethos of my family. You know, in a sense, they were doing that classic thing that parents try and do. They were trying to better us. They hadn't gone to those sort of schools. And I reacted very strongly against the little bit of Britain that this school actually was in the middle of Bray. And I suppose the summers were all the more important to me for that, because they were a total escape from that very regimented prep school life, where I was a day boarder. I was there from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock in the evening, 6 days a week. We were not only discouraged, we were forbidden to have any contact with townspeople during term time, in case we would bring disease into school. So even if my parents would have gone to the pictures on a Sunday, we couldn't have. You know, you were very, very restricted. So I reacted very strongly against that, and I took a hurley onto a hockey pitch at the age of about 12. And I began reading some Republican texts. I remember, well, not very Republican, but I remember reading a biography of Michael Collins and having it confiscated. And I also remember a moment where another boy in the class, whose name, oddly enough, his surname happened to be Britton, but he drew an Irish tricolour and put it on his pencil box. Just out of, you know, an idle kind of thing that amused him. And one of the teachers came in, saw the tricolour, picked it up, and said, "I always knew you were a bit of a Bolshevik, Britton, but there's no need to fly the red flag in here." And I had no idea what a Bolshevik was, but I immediately thought a Bolshevik must be rather a good thing if this teacher hated it so much. So in many ways, that school made me kind of reactively a Republican and a leftist without having really any framework for those thoughts at that time.
Because, yeah, you mean you become quite politicised in the 70s as a young fella. I mean, obviously the world's in turmoil. You have 1968, 1969, you've Paris, you've Northern Ireland happening, student politics quite intense. But for you, what was happening? Because you later on join Official Sinn Féin, and as you say, that reaction to your grounding in the prep school, that you become much more of a Republican.
Yes, and I wasn't wildly political at all. It was very reactive. And it was also about wanting to belong. You know, something told me that these people that I was at school with, not my fellow pupils, many of whom were good guys that I had good friendships with, but many of our teachers lived in a bubble that I kind of knew instinctively wasn't the Ireland I was growing up in. And I was then very fortunate in that my parents couldn't afford to send me to the second stage of that process, which would have been a public school like St. Columba's. And instead I was sent to what was then a VOCA school in Black Rock, which was a kind of shabby bohemian middle-class Protestant school, a very different kind of animal, kind of quite liberal in its thinking, quite loose in its discipline. And I enjoyed it enormously. I had a very good time there, kind of had a, you know, growing up, teenage, girls and rock and roll and beginning to look for the psychedelics that were emerging through our records in the late 60s and in the kind of Dunleary, Blackrock area. And I wasn't very political really until I remember John de Courcy Ireland, who was teaching in another school that merged with ours, and he came to teach us history and geography in my final year. And he was a really inspirational teacher. You know, I suppose everybody says they have one of somebody who's a big influence on them. And this guy comes in and he's, you know, he's been in the Merchant Navy and he always walks to school in a sports coat. He was very unconventional in many ways. And he had traveled the world. He'd been a communist until, I think, the mid-50s. I think he probably left the Communist Party over the invasion of Hungary. But he always had a socialist homeland. So in the period I knew him, the countries he idealized would have been Tito's Yugoslavia and Boumediene's Algeria. And he talked about those countries, and he'd been to those countries, and he knew people there. So he was a fascinating man. But that year of his teaching us coincided with the explosion of the conflict in Northern Ireland. It coincided with the kind of peak of the anti-Vietnam War protests in the United States. And I began to go on anti-Vietnam protests in Dublin. And I remember a key moment where we kind of moved from slogans like, you know, Yankees out of Vietnam, to saying victory to the Viet Cong. It was a switch. You were no longer just opposing the American presence. You were supporting something else, which was the international socialist movement dominated by the Soviet Union. So I began to flirt with those ideas. But as the Northern conflict developed and I looked at what was happening on the ground, and you supported the civil rights movement, and then Bloody Sunday happens. And OK, so do you need to go further than support for a kind of pacifist civil rights movement? Do you move towards armed struggle, as we romantically called it? And I was always very uncomfortable with the provisionals, to put it mildly. I thought the provisionals were conducting a ethically wrong and also very, very dangerous campaign that seemed to me likely to lead to a sectarian civil war. And I was very attracted, and maybe this was the Protestant in me, though I'd ceased to be a Protestant in any meaningful religious sense from the age of about 15. But I became attracted towards the officials, because the officials' doctrine, if you like, was that we had to unite the people before we united the island. And so rather than provoke a sectarian war with the Protestant working class, we would attempt to build bridges to them. Now, as we all know, the officials failed pretty miserably in building those bridges. But I think it was an honourable effort. with many bad things along the way that I'm not proud of. But I think these were very turbulent times. And there was that sense also, you know, that you have to make a commitment. And I remember a key moment for me in a sense of deciding to join a party, and a party that at the time had a military wing, was what happened in Chile when the socialist leader Salvador Allende was elected in Chile. The Americans backed the military to overthrow him and set up a really vicious military dictatorship. And so it did seem to me that there was no way for a socialist party to come to power in the capitalist world if it didn't have something more than votes behind it. And that's very dangerous thinking, and I think I was probably wrong, but at the time it seemed to make sense.
It's always interesting to have a conversation with our young self, and in some ways that idealism of a socialist paradise, you might think, comes up again and again, you know, whether, as you say, being on anti-Vietnam marches and actually it going from not just being anti-war but supporting the Viet Cong. And also then much later in my time, there was huge romanticism around Nicaragua, and so many people went as volunteers, and Daniel Ortega was at that stage the revolutionary hope for a socialist place, a socialist paradise. And now you look at what has become this dictatorship in a sense. So, you know, when we look back at that, at those engagements we had politically with ideas, it can often be that confrontation or that conflict between ideals and reality.
Yeah, and it's very complicated in that, you know, in the 1980s, I became very, very disturbed by what I saw as a remnant of militarism within the officials, which was very secret, but, you know, if you kept your eyes open, it was there. I was also, you know, my eyes were, they should never have been closed, but they were much more open to the very negative aspects of life in the so-called socialist countries, and the Soviet Union in particular. And I left the party in the mid-1980s, and I had hopes then that perhaps you could achieve a just, fair society through social democracy. And I maintained those beliefs up until 2008. And then 2008 and the banking crisis has really made me think again. There's no movement that I can really identify with at the moment, except the environmental movement in the broadest sense. But I was so horrified by what happened in 2008, and maybe particularly in 2011, when the Labour Party really became, in my view, a kind of vehicle for making
the vicious austerity
that Fine Gael were imposing. They became the vehicle for pacifying the large section of the Irish working class that they represented, and somehow supposedly sugaring this pill. And really what happened then was absolutely unacceptable. A very small group of people took a huge amount of money from the rest of us, and people suffered terribly as a result. And there has been no resolution of that.
No. I suppose we should say, for people who are too young to know, that Official Sinn Féin becomes, later on, the Workers' Party, becomes, later on, Democratic Left. So in some ways, the modern Labour Party has elements of that merging through it as well. But this idea, that conflict between ideals and reality, as you say, when we crossed paths in the Irish Times, when I joined, I went into the Irish Times as a very young one in the mid-80s and then went up to Northern Ireland as a reporter for a few years. But you were covering the Basque conflict and ETA, and that's the source of your book, Dirty War, Clean Hands. And Spain became a really big part of your life. And obviously for many people, ETA and the Basque independence struggle equally has elements of that romanticism about it. But that was in so many ways a very bloody civil war, and in still has ramifications in modern Spain. But what drew you to Spain and to become so deeply invested in Spain and particularly in the Basque conflict and in covering it? Because it's still a big part of your life, Spain itself.
Hugely. Hugely. And it also brought me back to nature, which was curious, though it took me a long time to really recognize that. I went there by chance. I'd finished university in 1975. I had absolutely no career ambitions. I was very political, at least in my own head. And I did think there was going to be revolutionary change within the next couple of years. So there was no point in having a career. I had no career ambitions whatsoever. Very unlike a lot of my comrades, actually, who were building very successful careers in RTE at exactly the same time. But while I didn't want a career, I did want, you know, and this was, I suppose, the Protestant coming out in me in some way, I did want to pay my father back for some debts I had from university. And a Spanish guy told me in the summer of 75, it's very easy to make money teaching English in Bilbao. And I thought, oh, Bilbao's the Basque country. Basques, there's an independence movement there that seems to have some parallels with Ireland. It might be an interesting place to go. And I went there and was able to make the money I needed to make very easily. And I became fascinated by the whole culture. I always say I learned to eat in the Basque country because I'd never paid much attention to food in Ireland, except as a fuel. And in the Basque country, I learned this wonderful thing that, you know, it's not a sort of upper class thing to go to a restaurant in the Basque country. It's something that, you know, truck drivers do, and they're very fussy about their food. And I found I was made very welcome there as an Irish person, often for rather spurious reasons. You know, there was this idea, particularly if you were, you know, if you were in a village that was largely Basque nationalist and you were Irish, well, you were made welcome. But they didn't have a clue what was going on in Ireland. And we didn't have really much clue what was going on there. And I began to try, and I suppose it was a kind of parallel universe. Here you had an armed left-wing movement, again, split into two wings. In the Basque case, the milis and the polymilis, the militaries and the political militaries. And the officials were a bit more like the political militaries, and the provos were more like the milis. And I suppose it gave me an opportunity, in a way, you could say, to live vicariously some of what I'd been living in Ireland. And it gave me a kind of a distance that, in analysing what was happening in the Basque country, maybe I could understand what was happening in Ireland better. And I always found the Basque country and Ireland are fascinating because there are lots of similarities, but every similarity is also a difference. So teasing out those ideas became very fascinating for me. And I formed very deep friendships there. And I talked to everyone across the political spectrum. And I finally then became fascinated by this story of the dirty war within the Basque conflict, if you like, when the Socialist Party, Spanish government, which should have been an exemplary democratic government, began to use death squads against ETA. And it so happened that an ex-flatmate of mine from 1975 had become a very senior member of the Socialist administration and was running these death squads. So I thought, well, if I could write a book about this, it wouldn't just be what the Spanish call a book of denunciation, that it would be more a book of trying to understand what was motivating all these actors to do the terrible things they were doing.
And how somebody becomes the leader of a death squad like that.
So yes, and so I hoped he would talk to me. He then, you know, he was The dirty war in Spain was odd in one respect compared to what the British did in Northern Ireland, in that some of the leading political protagonists were actually identified, brought to trial, and went to jail. So they always managed to get out very quickly. And he was one of the people who was convicted and went to jail. I'd always hoped he would talk to me, but I mean, he'd stayed in my parents' house in 1976. We were that close at that time. But we had grown, obviously, completely apart, and he would never talk to me in any meaningful way. To my enormous surprise, one of his senior colleagues in the Socialist Party did, and gave me an interview, which I think really did reveal the thinking of the brains behind the death squad. So, you know, it's happened so often in writing. You think one thing is going to open a door for you, but you actually find that's not the thing that opens the door for you, but there's a door beside them that you haven't noticed, and you walk through that one instead.
And as you say, being in Spain also brought you back to nature and brought you back to that experience of your childhood in the Nissan hut in the Sugarloaf. And that's where so much of your life and time now is, in this idea of restoration and ecological restoration. Your book, Our Once and Future Planet, I mean, that's 2018, so quite some time after your Basque writing. But this marked a completely different juncture in your life. And in a sense, you go from that experience of being the lefty in the official Sinn Féin to where you are now, which, as you say, the only politics that you're committing 100% to is that of the environment. But what brought you to write Our Once and Future Planet?
Well, it was, in a way, my Basque book, the first Basque book, Dirty War, Clean Hands, to my surprise, got a lot of academic respectability. I hadn't written it as an academic book, but it ended up being published by Cork University Press and then by Yale in the States. And so I was invited to the University of Iowa, to the International Writers Program, on the back of that book. And I had already begun to develop this idea that I wanted to write a book about nature and culture. I had this idea of following cranes and other migratory birds, not really as a bird watcher, but as a kind of culture watcher, and to see, you know, what do people say about cranes when they arrive in southern Spain at the beginning of winter, and what do people in Sweden say when they arrive in spring? And what myths are associated with them. And I thought then you could look at birds that migrate from, you know, eagles that migrate from Africa through the Middle East into Europe. It seemed to me to offer wonderful cultural journeys as well. So those ideas were swimming around in my head. And I was very lucky. And on that program, the director was a poet and environmentalist called Christopher Merrill. Very interesting man. And he brought us out on a weekend of prairie restoration with the great American writer Peter Matheson. And this phrase, the phrase ecological restoration blew me away, because restoration to me was something you did to a car or a painting or a house. But the idea that you could restore a damaged ecosystem seemed absolutely revolutionary to me, because insofar as I thought about it at all, I'd grown up with the model that I suspect most of us still have, which is that we do two things with nature. We develop it for our own use, as we must, but in so doing, we degrade it and perhaps ultimately destroy it, or we preserve it as if it's something you could put in a jar, and we call the jars national parks, and we build fences around them, and the only people in national parks are scientists and tourists. That's a terribly sterile idea. Nature's over there and we're over here. What I loved about restoration was it was kind of saying we live within ecosystems, and if we managed ourselves and our lives within those ecosystems better, we could restore them to their full health, their full biodiversity. And I began to learn that this also could have impacts and very positive impacts on slowing down climate change. So I became really excited about this idea of restoration, and it gave me an opportunity to find out that, yes, in Vietnam, I found restoration projects in Australia, in Costa Rica, in Mexico, and in Ireland. I found people were restoring bogs, and that's extraordinary, and people are restoring woodlands and river systems. And the whole idea of restoration, it appealed to me. I much prefer the phrase restoration to rewilding, because I think rewilding is very problematic and it alienates a lot of people. And it suggests that there is a wild out there that's quite different from us. Whereas restoration is saying we're in a relationship with the ecosystem, and in a way to restore ourselves, we need to restore ecosystems. So there's an element of social restoration in this project as well. And, you know, it's excited me ever since. And it's been a great privilege to work with ordinary citizens and scientists who are working in this field.
What's lovely about your book, and what you also make a point of saying from the beginning, is that so much of what we talk about in climate change or in the environment is about despair and pessimism and this timeline to destruction, and that when it's reported, it's always seen as these inevitable erosions that are happening, and that the human, the one individual, can feel helpless or ineffectual in an ability to change. But then in looking at restoration, it also, as you say, restores our ability as people. And it's almost where we started when we talk about the pandemic, that the pandemic, if there was one grace to it, that it opened up people to walk in their 2K, their 5K, to pay attention, to really focus on how they were living in their local environment, and to also have much more of a commitment to what was happening around them. So you do use this line from T.S. Eliot, and I was a huge T.S. Eliot fan in my English Lit degree, but, you know, that we shall not cease from exploring, and at the end of it, our exploring, we will arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And that idea of looking at something and seeing it anew is very much part of what you're describing in restoration, that it is one where we move from denial and despair to hope and action, to actually being participatory in the change in our own environment.
Yeah, I think that's critical. My original title for my book, or original subtitle, would have actually been A Good News Story from the Environmental Movement, because I think that, you know, despair disables us. And there are good reasons to be very, very worried and very anxious at the moment, for sure. But that doesn't help us advance. And I think that restoration, also by the fact that you can restore with the simplest acts and very, very complex acts. So, you know, if you, instead of planting an exotic rhododendron in your garden, you plant a native willow tree, for example, that willow tree will support native species in a way that the rhododendron mainly won't. So you're actually kicking in to that cycle of restoration with a very small act. At the same time, you know, scientifically informed projects are actually restoring very large landscapes surprisingly quickly and surprisingly effectively, because nature is very resilient. And, you know, while it does require management, you manage as little as possible. You let nature do as much of the heavy lifting as the damaged system can still do. And you're essentially enabling the system to come back to a point where it can do all that heavy lifting itself.
I mean, do you have a sense of optimism, Paddy, about the pandemic being a time for awakening for human beings? Because we have had this intense period of quiet skies and of pausing from what often seems this hectic pace and schedule that we put ourselves on. I mean, there's two ways of looking at it, that historically, and in fact, everything I've ever studied is history. And history might tell us that we'll bounce back, and actually we'll bury all these sense of the pandemic, goodwill to nature, in our rush to actually, fuel the global economy on again. But there is that sense that because it's been sustained and there's been such a conversation about it, that many human beings and many of us will take away some aspects of self-awareness and self-knowledge from this period of the long pause. How do you see it? I mean, has the pandemic accelerated the conversation about restoration? Has it brought more public engagement to it? Or would you be more of the mindset that once, you know, we can get busy again, we'll just get busy?
I was more hopeful during the first lockdown, where it seemed to me a real change was happening. Then I think things began to become very ragged. And I also think if we look at things globally, responses to the pandemic have been so irrational. So if you look at the response of the Trump administration, the first responses of the Boris Johnson, Bolsonaro in Brazil, more recently Modi in India. And it's very hard to be optimistic about our future on this planet when you see large numbers of people following such, to me, obviously irrational leaders. I still, despite this lip service that's paid to words like sustainability by the government today and by opposition parties, I don't think that very many of them, I sometimes wonder if even the Green Party, has actually really understood the magnitude of change that is required, not only a change in how we live, but a change in our attitudes. I think...
In our values.
In our values.
I mean, surely at the moment, the Greens are part of a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael coalition, and in some ways in a similar position to where you saw Labour during the post-banking crisis coalition and the austerity programme.
Yeah, and of course I think the Greens bear a heavy responsibility for their collaboration with Fianna Fáil in the first phase of the post-banking crisis. This time around, I mean, I think you have to give them credit for the climate bill is a very significant achievement. I'm not sure that they grasped the importance of the biodiversity emergency to anything like the same extent or the importance of restoration. I think they're beginning to. I think a lot is still to play for. We need to see if the National Parks and Wildlife Service and that whole area of managing biodiversity in the country is going to be done properly, because it has been done in the most extraordinarily haphazard is the most complimentary term I could come up with. It's under-resourced for sure, but the problem isn't just under-resourcing. The problem is really bad structures. The problem is national parks which are not directed by scientific programs and are falling apart as a result. Now, there is a review of the National Parks and Wildlife Service underway. The review is being done by people who are very well informed, and I think will do a very good job, but I think there will be big efforts to bury this review. So I think it's too early to judge the Green Party and this government yet, for sure. But I go back again to kind of a slogan that I think was, it's used by a number of people, but I think the Italian Marxist Gramsci used it, which is said that in the 1930s under fascism, our times call for pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. And in a sense, I apply that to the environment and to society, because when I say that the environmental movement is the only one I identify with, those are the kind of obvious goals I work for every day. But I also work a little with, you know, refugees and asylum seekers, those kind of issues. And I do believe that there is no salvation for the environment without a salvation for our society, and particularly for the poorest people in our society.
Your social conscience and that sense of your politics from the 70s and 80s really connects with how you're using the environment and this story of restoration with, say, asylum seekers. You've created with the Syrian Mohammed Ashour these sanctuary walks. What's the sanctuary walks?
Like everybody else, I was very upset by what I saw happening 5, 6, 7 years ago in the Mediterranean, and continues happening to this day, of, you know, little children being washed up, drowned on beaches. This was Europe. This was this wealthy, social democratic European Union. And on the edge of our world, there are millions and millions of distressed people and people fleeing wars, etc., etc. So I wanted to do something about it. No idea what I could do. And I joined an organization called Dublin City of Sanctuary. And people were talking about sanctuary in universities, sanctuary in faith groups, etc., etc. All very good ideas, and they were doing some wonderful stuff. And I suddenly thought, why not sanctuary in nature? You know, mightn't there be people in direct provision who might enjoy going out for a walk in nature? And from the beginning, I had the idea that it's an exchange. It's not a gift. We invite people to come out on walks with us, and we show them, you know, Irish plants, Irish birds, Irish animals, Irish landscapes. And we ask them about, you know, the birds and animals, plants that they may be familiar with. So I started it in a very ad hoc way. Sometimes just two or three people came out. And it began to build. And then Mohammed arrived one day. I think I'd met him at a meeting in Dublin, and he came out on one of the trips. And he began to come more and more, and he began to bring more Syrian friends with him. And one day he said to me, he said, you know, Paddy, people really like what we're doing, and the numbers were getting bigger. But he said, people would like to see the built heritage. He happens to be an architect. They would like to see the built heritage, the cultural heritage of Ireland, as well as the natural heritage. So we talked about it a bit, and he helped me organise a trip to Castletown House. So we went to see the architecture of Castletown House and the lifestyle and all the rest of it. But we also went to the gardens and the grounds and the River Liffey nearby. And so we began to think of, you know, could we actually call this sanctuary in nature and heritage? And at this point, I realized that Mohammed was actually the mainstay of the whole operation. And so I asked him to become my partner. And we're just actually, again, as we're speaking, I sent out an email about the first of our post-pandemic trips. Because obviously, and it's going to be very difficult, because a lot of the things that we could do before, we were encouraging people to mix, to eat together, to break out of their family groups and meet people from other cultures, etc. It's going to be much harder to do that, because for the moment, people are going to have to remain in their family or personal bubbles and socially distance from other ones. But we're doing one to Christchurch Cathedral as part of Refugee Week. Mohammed again has organised a visionary little exhibition called Homing Pigeons, which are bird illustrations that children in Aleppo, still living in Aleppo, which is his home city, have sent to Dublin. And we'll go to the Wildflower Garden in St. Audouin's nearby. And then somebody from Birdwatch Ireland, who've become involved in helping us as well with the nature walk this time.
Brilliant. Paddy, I know that you split your life before the pandemic between Dublin in Stonybatter and Wicklow in your beautiful hideaway in nature. You're long married to Trish, who, of course, has a very high-profile life with Disney. But what's your remaining wish list for somebody who's travelled so much and who's now made the environment or ecological restoration your mission?
Oh, that's a painful question in some ways, because I've been trying through the pandemic and largely failing, though I think I'm beginning to get there. I have this idea. I turned 70 very recently.
Congratulations.
And I don't know. Yeah, well, it's, I don't know. it's doesn't always feel like something you want to be congratulated for. But
the alternative
much
is
better,
much worse.
Much
the
better than the alternative.
Is much worse.
I do believe that I would like if I survive another 10 years, I would like them to be much more reflective years, much slower years. I want to do less but do it better. I'm increasingly loath the speed of social media. I want more and more and more to spend days reading a single book and not listening to the news. I've almost stopped listening to the news in this latter phase of the pandemic, actually, because I was getting so angry with the successive incompetent acts of governments. I want to focus more. I want to spend more time with the people I love, and but continue making new friends. And, you know, Sanctuary and Nature and Heritage is a wonderful way to do that. I will still travel a bit, but I'll think a lot more carefully about travel in future. And one of my most striking moments in the last few days was I use a hand lens, which is like a baby microscope, to look at flowers or insects in more detail. And I've started studying grasses. And, you know, we walk on grass all the time, if we're lucky. We don't notice it very much. If you look at sweet vernal grass, which is just the earliest one to come into flower, and it's in flower at the moment, and if you look at it through a hand lens, it is like visiting a cathedral. There is this thing which appears to be a completely insignificant, grubby little plant, and you look at it in detail, and it's kind of, you know, psychedelic memories come into play, I suppose, but you see the infinity in the very small, and you realize that there are, you know, incredibly beautiful, quite erotic shapes. These are the sexual parts of a plant, after all, but they're all displayed in this extraordinary way that no designer could emulate. And so I want to have more moments like that, moments of kind of stillness, and moments of focus. But I want to have fun again. I do look forward to having a few pints and listening to traditional music.
I know that you connect with the title of our podcast, The Family of Things. And as you're talking there, it reminds me how Mary Oliver goes in that poem where she says, "Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination and calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things." Because that sounds a little bit what you're talking about, is that in the end, that's where we are rounded. Journey comes through is to recognize that that's what we're part of.
Well, it's very strange you should say that, because I don't know if I told you this, but I, through the first 6 to 7 months of the pandemic, I read Mary Oliver every day. I think I've read most of her poems several times over, some of them many, many times over. And I think essentially, you know, an awful lot of what her poetry does is capturing that, the kind of intense focus, which is incredibly liberating, because it reminds you of where you really are in the world rather than where your brain is thinking you are.
Rather than where you're going or where you come from, but where you are right now. Paddy, it's been lovely to catch up with you, and hopefully we'll meet in human form on a walk in nature in the Phoenix Park or somewhere like that again. But good luck with everything you're doing, and hope to read and hear from you again soon. Thanks for joining us here on The Family of Things.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me. It's been, I feel like I've been psychoanalyzing myself with your questions, so thank you very much.
Not at all. Talk to you soon. Thanks, Paddy.
Thank you.